And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Change is in the air. People are getting excited about making a better world. So when we talk about taking care of the Earth with its millions and millions of different species and its infinite stretches of wonder, this whole preservation theme may just have a real chance of happening. Today, we hear from the world's leading naturalist, the legendary E.O. Wilson, about a new project he's heading up to identify every species on Earth, and he invites you to help. And you may be surprised to hear what the U.S. government is doing to preserve our natural landscapes. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today, you're going to get an update on the complexity of life on Earth from one of the world's leading naturalists, E.O. Wilson. This legendary biologist, who knows more about this than almost anyone else on Earth, has come to a time in his life when technology and wisdom converge to begin to create the definitive repository of record for every species on Earth. His call to action is rich with information, and he's going to be joining us during the weekly Earth Summit that begins in just a moment. In segment two, as the imprint of human existence spreads throughout the land, we hear a lot about the effects this is having on the diversity of life itself. But our natural landscapes are in decline as well. Where once we could experience the unbroken beauty of our open spaces, revel in the beauty of our great vistas, now even these are vanishing. In segment two, you may be surprised to know that the U.S. government has a program to protect our natural landscape. We'll talk with Elena Daly of the National Landscape Conservation System. That's coming up. And, of course, the Nature News Update as well. But now, it's time for the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and today we are fortunate to hear from one of the most prodigious authorities and prestigious voices of wonder, Dr. E.O. Wilson. Today he enriches us with an overview of the vast diversity of species on Earth and brings us up to date on the status of these creatures. In order to help understand life on Earth, Dr. Wilson is making a proposal to create the tools needed to inspire and record the preservation of life's biodiversity, the Encyclopedia of Life.
Please keep in mind that if we were to wipe out insects alone, just that group alone on this planet, which we are trying hard to do, the rest of life and humanity with it would mostly disappear from the land and within a few months. So how did I come to this particular position of advocacy? As a little boy, through my teenage years, I became increasingly fascinated by the diversity of life. I had a butterfly period, a snake period, a bird period, a fish period, a cave period, and finally, and definitively, an ant period. By my college years, I was a devoted myrmecologist, a specialist on the biology of ants, but my attention and research continued to make journeys across the great variety of life on Earth in general, including all that it means to us as a species, how little we understand it, and how pressing a danger that our activities has created for it. Out of that broader study has emerged a concern and an ambition crystallized in the wish that I'm about to make to you. My choice is the culmination of a lifetime commitment that began with growing up on the Gulf Coast of Alabama and the Florida Peninsula. As far back as I can remember, I was enchanted by the natural beauty of that region and the almost tropical exuberance of the plants and animals that grow there. One day when I was only 7 years old and fishing, I pulled a pinfish, they're called, with sharp dorsal spines, up too hard and fast, and I blinded myself in one eye. I later discovered I was also hard of hearing, possibly congenitally in the upper registers. So, in planning to be a professional naturalist, I never considered anything else in my entire life. I found that I was lousy at bird watching and couldn't track frog calls either. So I turned to the teeming small creatures that can be held between the thumb and forefinger. The little things that compose the foundation of our ecosystems, the little things, as I like to say, who run the world. In so doing, I reached a frontier of biology so strange, so rich, that it seemed as though it exists on another planet. In fact, we live on a mostly unexplored planet. The great majority of organisms on Earth remain unknown to science. In the last 30 years, thanks to explorations in remote parts of the world and advances in technology, biologists have, for example, added a full one-third of the known frog and other amphibian species to bring the current total to 5,400, and more continue to pour in. Two new kinds of whales have been discovered, along with two new antelopes, dozens of monkey species, and a new kind of elephant, and even a distinct kind of gorilla. At the extreme opposite end of the size scale is a class of marine bacteria, the prochlorococci. That will be on the final exam. Although discovered only in 1988, are now recognized as likely the most abundant organisms on Earth, and moreover responsible for a large part of the photosynthesis that occurs in the ocean. These bacteria were not uncovered sooner because they are also among the smallest of all Earth's organisms, so minute that they cannot be seen with conventional optical microscopy. Yet life in the sea may depend on these tiny creatures. These examples are just a first glimpse of our ignorance of life on this planet. Consider the fungi, including mushrooms, rust, molds, and many disease-causing organisms. 60,000 species are known to science, but more than 1.5 million have been estimated to exist. Consider the nematode roundworms, the most abundant of all animals. 4 out of 5 animals on Earth are nematode worms. If all solid material except nematode worms were to be eliminated, you could still see the ghostly outline of most of it in nematode worms. About 16,000 species of nematode worms have been discovered and diagnosed by scientists. There could be hundreds of thousands of them, even millions still unknown. This vast domain of hidden biodiversity is increased still further by the dark matter of the biological world. The bacteria which within just the last several years still were known from only about 6,000 species of bacteria worldwide. But that number of bacteria species to be found in 1 gram of soil, just a little handful of soil, in the 10 billion bacteria that would be there. It's been estimated that a single ton of soil, fertile soil, contains approximately 4 million species of bacteria, all unknown. So the question is, what are they all doing? The fact is, we don't know. We are living on a planet with a lot of activities with reference to the living environment done by faith and guess alone. Our lives depend upon these creatures. They are, to take an example close to home, there are over 500 species of bacteria now known, friendly bacteria living symbiotically in your mouth and throat, probably necessary to your health for holding off pathogenic bacteria. The viruses, those quasi-organisms, among which are the prophages, the gene weavers that promote the continued evolution and lives of the bacteria, are a virtually unknown frontier of modern biology, a world unto themselves. What constitutes a viral species is still unresolved, although they're obviously of enormous importance to us. But this much we can say, the variety of genes on the planet in viruses exceeds, or is likely to exceed, that and all of the rest of life combined. Nowadays, in addressing microbial biodiversity, scientists are like explorers in a rowboat launched onto the Pacific Ocean. But that is changing rapidly with the aid of new genomic technology. Already it is possible to sequence the entire genetic code of a bacterium in under 4 hours. Soon we will be in a position to go forth in the field with sequencers on our back to hunt bacteria in tiny crevices of the environment, of the habitat surface, in the way you go watching for birds with binoculars. What will we find as we map the living world, as finally we get this underway seriously? As we move past the relatively gigantic mammals, birds, frogs, and plants, to the more elusive insects and other small invertebrates, and then beyond, to the countless millions of organisms in the invisible living world that envelop and live within humanity. Already, what were thought to be bacteria for generations have been found to compose instead two great domains of microorganisms, the true bacteria and one-celled organisms, the archaea, which are closer than are the bacteria to the eukarya, the group that we belong to. Some serious biologists, and I count myself among them, have begun to wonder that among the enormous and still unknown diversity of microorganisms, one might, just might, find aliens among them, true aliens, stocks that arrive from outer space. They've had billions of years to do it. But especially during the earliest period of biological evolution on this planet, we do know that some bacterial species that have earthly origin are capable of almost unimaginable extremes of temperature and other harsh changes in environment, including hard radiation strong enough and maintained long enough to crack the Pyrex vessels around the growing population of bacteria. There may be a temptation to treat the biosphere holistically and the species that compose it as a great flux of entities hardly worth distinguishing one from the other. But each of these species, even the tiniest of the aforementioned prochlorococci, are masterpieces of evolution. Each has persisted for thousands to millions of years. Each is exquisitely adapted to the environment in which it lives, interlocked with other species to form the ecosystems upon which our own lives depend in ways we have not begun even to imagine. We will destroy these ecosystems and the species composing them at the peril of our own existence. And unfortunately, we are destroying them with ingenuity and ceaseless energy. My own epiphany as a conservationist came in 1953 while a Harvard graduate student searching for rare ants found in the mountain forest of Cuba. Ants that shine in the sunlight, metallic green or metallic blue according to species, and one species I discovered, metallic gold. I found my magical ants, but only after a tough climb into the mountains where the last of the native Cuban forest hung on, and were then, and still are, being cut back. I realized then that these species, and a large part of the other unique, marvelous animals and plants of that island, and this is true of practically every part of the world, which took millions of years to evolve, are in the process of disappearing forever, and so it is everywhere one looks. The human juggernaut is permanently eroding Earth's ancient biosphere by a combination of forces that can be summarized by the acronym HIPPO, the animal HIPPO. H is for habitat destruction, including climate change forced by greenhouse gases. I is for the invasive species like the ants, the fire ants, the zebra mussels, and brome grasses, and pathogenic bacteria and viruses that are flooding every country and at an exponential rate. That's the I. The P, the first one in HIPPO, is for pollution. The second is for continued population, human population expansion. And the final letter is O, is for over-harvesting, driving species into extinction by excessive hunting and fishing. The HIPPO juggernaut we have created, if unabated, is destined, according to the best estimates of ongoing biodiversity research, to reduce half of Earth's still surviving animal and plant species to extinction or critical endangerment by the end of the century. Human-forced climate change alone, again, if unabated, could eliminate a quarter of surviving species during the next five decades. What will we and all future generations lose if much of the living environment is thus degraded? Huge potential sources of scientific information yet to be gathered. Much of our environmental stability and new kinds of pharmaceuticals and new products of unimaginable strength and value, all thrown away. The loss will inflict a heavy price in wealth, security, and yes, spirituality for all time to come, because previous cataclysms of this kind, the last one that ended the age of dinosaurs, took normally 5 to 10 million years to repair. Sadly, our knowledge of biodiversity is so incomplete that we are at risk of losing a great deal of it before it is even discovered. For example, even in the United States, the 200,000 species known currently may be found to be only partial in coverage, is mostly unknown to us. In basic biology, only about 15% of the known species have been studied well enough to evaluate their status. Of the 15% evaluated, 20% are classified as in peril, that is, in danger of extinction. That's in the United States. We are, in short, flying blind into our environmental future. We urgently need to change this. We need to have the biosphere properly explored so that we can understand and competently manage it. We need to settle down before we wreck the planet, and we need that knowledge. This should be a big science project equivalent to the Human Genome Project. It should be thought of as a biological moonshot with a timetable. So this brings me to my wish for TEDsters and to anyone else around the world who hears this talk. I wish we will work together to help create the key tools that we need to inspire preservation of Earth's biodiversity, and let us call it the Encyclopedia of Life. What is the Encyclopedia of Life? A concept that has already taken hold and is beginning to spread and be looked at seriously. It is an encyclopedia that lives on the internet and is contributed to by thousands of scientists around the world. Amateurs can do it also. It has an indefinitely expandable page for each species. It makes all key information about life on Earth accessible to anyone on demand, anywhere in the world. I've written about this idea before, and I know there are people in this room who have expanded or expended significant effort on it in the past. But what excites me is that since I first put forward this particular idea in that form, science has advanced, technology has moved forward. Today, the practicalities of making such an encyclopedia, regardless of the magnitude of the information put into it, are within reach, have made reality within reach. Indeed, in the past year, a group of influential scientific institutions have begun mobilizing to realize this dream. I wish you would help them. Working together, we can make this real. The encyclopedia will quickly pay for itself in practical applications. It will address transcendent qualities in the human consciousness and sense of human need. It will transform the science of biology in ways of obvious benefit to humanity. And most of all, it can inspire a new generation of biologists to continue the quest that started for me personally 60 years ago, to search for life, to understand it, and finally, above all, to preserve it. That is my wish. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. E.O. Wilson. Take his words to heart, for few on Earth have such a sense of the complexity of our biosphere. It is, as he makes so clear, a sphere of near-infinite complexity. And we live in an era when these truths will be revealed, recorded, and interpreted. This will become, to those who take the time to learn, one of the most fascinating quests in the history of the world. To learn more about this project, visit www.eol.org. And to hear more from some of the world's leading men and women of ideas and action, please visit www.ted.com, which made this speech possible. This is Sidney Wildsmith, inviting you to join us each week for the most important 15 minutes on Earth, here on the Weekly Earth Summit. And now, the Nature News Update. The Sea Shepherd conservation ship, the Steve Irwin, is preparing to return to the Southern Ocean's Whale Sanctuary following a harrowing confrontation in which two conservation seamen were held hostage on a Japanese ship. The two were released, with one sailor suffering minor injuries. The Steve Irwin's strategy in unofficial alliance with Greenpeace is to keep the Japanese fleet of 8 ships on the move, thus burning up their fuel without being able to hunt and catch whales. So far, the Japanese whaling fleet has burned up 2,000 tons of fuel without catching a single whale. The Steve Irwin is being tailed continuously by what Sea Shepherd Captain Paul Watson refers to as a mystery ship. The Sea Shepherd Conservation Society is in need of volunteers with mechanical, navigational, medical, seamanship, and cooking skills. To contact the organization, go to www.seashepherd.org. A plan to log the nation's largest national forest, the Songus National Forest in Alaska, has been proposed. The plan would open up 3.4 million of the 17 million acres to clear-cutting, road building, and development. Environmentalists plan to challenge the plan in the courts, while forest interests intend to do the same, but obviously for opposing reasons. The plan was drawn up with a promise to provide assistance to the ailing lumber industry in Alaska and bring revenues to the state. Lawsuits by environmental groups have attempted to move the site of the logging from remote and roadless areas to more accessible areas already served by roads. Animal conservationists have for years been developing captive breeding programs for endangered species. The programs ultimately release the animals into the wild in the hopes that they will integrate and become part of a viable wild population. However, recent studies have indicated that such programs have a minimal success rate, with an average of only 33% of released captive-bred animals actually surviving. This raises questions about the current approach. The alternative, moving small numbers of captured animals to new locations, does provide a higher success rate. But this practice can be difficult when populations are already diminished. Death of captive-bred animals is usually due to being shot or killed, as they exhibit less fear of humans, a diminished ability to socialize and mate with wild populations, and a lack of viable skills for hunting and feeding. New strategies will include raising captive-bred animals in complete isolation from human interaction in large enclosures and providing only live prey animals to permit the animals to develop survival skills. Then, only young raised in this situation will be released. Besides oil and other metals, which are rising in price due to reduced availability, water joins them now in the commodities market, as water shortages in California are enticing farmers to opt out of food production and into water sales. Farmers in the San Joaquin Valley in particular, which rely on subsidized water pricing to maintain market viability, are beginning negotiations with water-strapped Los Angeles to purchase water allocated to them, receiving as much as 3 times the usual rate. These farmers will therefore leave their fields fallow. This in turn will have unspecified impacts on food prices, which will include rice, cantaloupe, and tomatoes around the Sacramento area. Much water throughout California comes from northern areas of the state and from the Colorado River. Recent court decisions restricting redistribution to protect an endangered fish species, as well as the record low levels available from the Colorado River, are hitting this area particularly hard. This is the worst drought condition in decades, with no real solution in sight. Meanwhile, water prices continue to soar, with subsidized rates of $30 to $60 per acre-foot, bringing now $200 on the open market. Many complain the taxpayers are subsidizing the farmers and paying higher prices as well. Anyone with a simple solution is encouraged to contact the governor. Hundreds of thousands of crop seed varieties from Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East will be heading for a remote island in the Arctic Circle. Deep within a mountain, a seed repository has been established to serve humankind in case, for any reason, crop viability is threatened. The Svalbard Global Seed Repository, created by Norway as a service to the world and supported by the Global Crop Diversity Trust, will officially receive its first seeds on February 28th. In the years ahead, over 600,000 crop seed varieties will be collected in viable quantities and stored in this underground refrigerator. More than a seed repository, the Svalbard Vault is in fact a genetic bank. Recently, seeds collected by the Global Network were sent to Afghanistan and Iraq to help restore diminished production due to the massive wars that are disrupting the natural agricultural practices and thereby threatening native seed viability. The seed gene bank has special merit as the effects of global warming are beginning to be felt. Hurricanes can be especially destructive to seed crops, wiping out whole seasons of seed crop in a single event. Preserving the Earth's diversity is a new field of international cooperation. It will, in the years ahead, spawn a huge new area of jobs throughout the world. And that's the news. In just a moment, we look at what's being done to preserve what we look at, as we talk with Elena Daly of the National Landscape Conservation System when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
That you don't know what you've got till it's gone. It paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? You paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
I'm a farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees.
That is Joni Mitchell, who warned us over 35 years ago about waking up to the destruction of our paradise. And the beat goes on, and it likely will until something drastic happens. But a few years back, someone had the sense imparted in that song and decided to keep what's important to us. And so, in just a moment, we go in-depth with the National Landscape Conservation System when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. In many respects, I was very lucky to have grown up in the Midwest because it was a place where the local people had a unique connection with the land because it was a very agrarian-based society. Although I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which was a city, I would have the good luck and good fortune every summer to head out to my grandparents who lived in Woodville, Wisconsin. If anybody in Woodville is listening, hello, population 300 and some people, and it was great. But about 1955, 1956, I was again fortunate because Disneyland had opened and my mother decided that it was important for we kids to experience this grand thing and as well to meet some relatives that we hadn't been in that close of contact with. So we hopped in a train and leaving from Milwaukee, headed down to Chicago and then headed west. And that journey affected my life to this day because for days we spent our times creeping into the western landscape. And the farther and the deeper we got, the more my mind just was taken away to places that I couldn't believe. It allowed my imagination to wander infinitely. And I was impressed with the grand, open spaces where there was nobody. Nobody for as far as I could see for hours and hours and hours. Occasionally we'd pass through little towns and communities. I'd recall, as we rode along on the train, seeing literally Native Americans, otherwise at that time known as Indians, on horseback. And I just couldn't believe it. I thought, this is all real. And as well, you'd see cowboys, cowboy hats on horseback. And what had I thought was sort of a legend of cowboys and Indians was in fact real. And I was totally drawn to that sense of America, the sense of open spaces and freedom. And it's what I dedicate my life to this day. Through the Wild Side News and the effort to make sure somehow that we're able to maintain this amazing landscape that we have. And that's one of the reasons that I'm really thrilled to welcome to the Wild Side News Elena Daly, who's the director of the National Landscape Conservation System that is associated with the Bureau of Land Management. She's talking to us now from Washington, D.C. Elena, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney. I'm really pleased to be here.
The National Landscape Conservation System is one that I've kind of known about, but I haven't heard very much about, and there's some reasons for that. What I'd like to do now is to really bring this information out to my listening public and to the world at large. Let's talk a little bit about the National Landscape Conservation System and what its mission is.
Our mission is to conserve and protect and restore those wonderful vistas that you very aptly described in your introduction of the American West, not just the visual, but the cultural, the socioeconomic ties, the working landscape that is a part of that wonderful landscape. When you look out, and I keep a quote on my desk, and it says, there is a landscape larger than the one you see. And it reminds me that when you look out there, you see part of it, but there is so much more going on within it. And that's what we're really after, is to make sure that these very special places in American history, what you described as these places of the mythic American West, remain as much as they can in their original context.
What's so fascinating about this is the fact that what we're really talking about is preserving what is America. We are a people of the West, of open spaces, of a sense of freedom. And that relationship of people to their land in the sort of a natural balance is what so many of us value. And actually, it's a way of life. So you have quite a challenge here. You are dedicated to trying to keep that sense of America alive. And talk a little bit about the scope of the National Landscape Conservation System in terms of the land that you are working to preserve and the landscapes.
Well, while you're right, it's a challenge. I have to tell you, I think I have the best job in government. We are a very diverse system. We have just about anything you can mention, think of. We have national monuments. We have national conservation areas, very similar to the Park Service, our sister agency. We also have wild and scenic rivers. We have historic and scenic trails, the California Trail, the Oregon Trail, those wonderful trails of visions and dreams that carried people west. We have the Old Spanish Trail, the De Anza Trail, these trails associated with the wonderful Spanish settlements of the Southwest, and a good many of them based on original Native American footpaths. So there's a whole bunch of stories surrounded there. And then wilderness areas, areas that Congress has set aside as part of our wilderness preservation system. So it's extremely diverse. But the commonality is always the American vision and dream and quest. It's a wonderful story of the American psyche.
I think you're right. You have one of the most interesting jobs that I can imagine.
Yes, it's great fun.
it is. You're very, very lucky. Talk a little bit about how it came to be, because it was initiated in 2000. Give us a little history.
It was June of 2000 when Secretary Bruce Babbitt, then Secretary of the Interior, set aside a group of national monuments, some of which had already been established for the Bureau of Land Management, but he collected them into this system. And what he wanted to do was to tell a different story than the National Park Service tells with its wonderful land, or the National Forest System, or the National Wildlife Refuge System. All of those have slightly different missions. And what he wanted to do, he is a native Arizonan, so he knew the story of the West very well. He wanted to tell that story, and he wanted to tell it in its own context. So he pulled together these special places and said, here's what we're going to do. We're not only going to pull them together, we're also going to talk about keeping them the way they are. And that's not a preservation. He very carefully chose the word conservation, which is a balance between use and sustainability, and that's really important for us. So when you go on to any one of these units, you very likely will see grazing. You very likely will see all sorts of recreation. People will be rafting rivers, they will be hiking wilderness areas, they will be doing a variety of things, but always connected to that spirit of the West and to the local community, so we can help tell that community story through these lands as well. It's really an interesting both bilateral approach of telling a national story as well as telling a very local and personal story.
Well, you refer to these as units. Obviously, not all BLM lands are included within these units.
That is correct. We have 37 monuments and conservation areas. Most of them were designated by presidential proclamation. Some of them have been designated by Congress. Santa Rosa San Jacinto in Palm Springs is legislatively established. The King Range, also in California, is legislatively established. And so are a couple of the other units in Idaho and Oregon and some of the other states. We tend to refer to them as units because they're very large. They tend to be several million acres, some of them. And then the rivers, the trails, and the wilderness areas as well, just kind of round it all out.
Well, here's what I'd like to know. Areas, these natural areas, have to be designated as units. What's the criteria for that? How does that come about?
Well, it's evolved. King Range has been around for a very long time, and it's a spectacular part of Northern California. That just sort of came about in the 1970s. It was recognized as a very special place, and Congress set it aside as a conservation area. What we are finding more and more frequently is that local people are now saying, we have a very special place, and they're approaching their congressional delegations and saying, we'd like to see this become part of this system. And some of those areas that have been developed that way or are in the process of being considered by Congress include areas like Piedras Blancas Lighthouse. We've had some interest from the folks who manage that. There are several places in New Mexico, dinosaur trackways and some others that have very special Snowy River, which is a cave system. And it's not one type of landscape. I think the variety alone is very exciting. We're seeing a real trend toward local people saying this is so special and so important, and recognizing that these small communities are seeing incredible growth in the West. They are saying themselves, before anything happens to this, we'd like to see it set aside, and so we know it's there. So people can go and appreciate and learn and be blown away by this incredible place.
One of the grand success stories was the designation of the Grand Escalante as a BLM unit. I know that there was a lot of interaction between the communities. I mean, historically, I'll tell you my little take on this, that there were communities who said, look, we've been using this area forever. This is a way of life. We take our trucks and head into this area here. And we're a little concerned that if you start designating this some sort of a protected area, we may lose that way of life. Interestingly enough, that really isn't your mission. It's to preserve that way of life. Talk a little bit about how in the world you go about doing that with these communities.
Well, it takes a lot of trust building. I think that's the most important thing. And we do a lot of communication with local communities. One of the real success stories in that one occurs in Arizona at an area known as Las Cienegas. And the local rancher was very concerned about how this would impact his livelihood. And he will tell you in very earthy language how these environmentalists from Phoenix came down. They were going to tell him how to run his ranch. Well, over the past 12 or 15 years, he and the environmentalist from Phoenix have become best friends. And the group in Las Cienegas, it's local people who sit down, and these are tremendously dedicated people, who sit down and help us design the vision for the monument. The rancher is still ranching. He's still very proud of what's going on. They're talking now about habitat restoration down there, reintroduction of native species, all kinds of wonderful things that because they've spent so much time working together and built this trust relationship, that the area itself has become a real boon to everyone. And it's that level of conversation and commitment by the Bureau and by local folks who really do love these very special places that allow a lot of the fear and the concern to dissipate. We need that local commitment. First of all, they're the people who know the area best and who know its stories and its histories and the things we should be paying attention to. So you spend a lot of time over a kitchen table and a cup of coffee and just getting to know each other. And what we found, too, is if you get people talking about what their goal for an area is rather than what their issues are, you keep the conversation in a very positive way. And most people, believe it or not, have very similar goals. It becomes a unifying theme. And so that gives you something to work toward. It's been a really interesting evolution to see how that has progressed with in various states, and it's happening all over. It's very exciting.
In terms of the vision of the entire program, how would you define sort of the matrix of values that you think qualify a community or an area for inclusion in the National Landscape Conservation System?
Well, because there are so many diverse elements to it, it's really hard to say it has to be this big or this sort of thing. Most of the authorizing proclamations, whether they're presidential or congressional, cite historic, ecological, cultural, or scientific values that set it apart. And the best examples I can give you would be Caxicatui between Albuquerque and Santa Fe is an amazing geologic formation. It's found on the Cochiti Pueblo. The only other example of this particular geologic feature is in Turkey. That qualifies as a unit. You look at Grand Staircase Escalante in southern Utah, this incredible broad red rock country with a history of settlement and a cultural history with tribal elements and the migration west. It's just a phenomenal story. We have found additionally there some of the most rare dinosaurs in the world. There have been phenomenal paleontological discoveries at Grand Staircase. If you look at King Range, that area of California known as the Lost Coast, phenomenal ecological values reside in this very, very special place that's difficult to get to but worth every step of the trudge to get to make. So they're very varied, but as long as you look at those cultural, ecological, historic, and scientific values. Another really interesting one is Canyons of the Ancients in southwestern Colorado, where we know that in certain areas you can have thousands of archaeological sites within a relatively small geographic area. It is teeming with archaeological sites. So it's just fabulous stuff, I guess is the best way to put it.
This image of what it is that you're preserving is extraordinary and represents the magnificent legacy of this country, which goes back into prehistoric times and as well more modern times in the 30s and the 40s as America was developing. And now we have the challenge, of course, moving into the 21st century, and that's part of your challenge right now, and that is how we deal with the fact that our populations are increasing so much and there's new pressures from many different perspectives being placed on these national landscape conservation units, otherwise known as the American ethos and culture. This is where kind of things are at this point. You're trying to establish legal protections for this. I believe that that's happening in Congress as we speak.
Yes. Senator Bingaman from New Mexico and Mr. Grijalva from Arizona have each introduced bills in their appropriate houses of Congress that would give legal status to the system. Because it was established by secretarial order, any secretary could actually, I wouldn't expect them to, but they could come in and just say, no, we don't need this anymore, and it would go away. And so the concern has been that we ought to recognize these places as wonderful, unique areas that are integral to the American psyche. And so these gentlemen have introduced it. It has not as yet been voted out as an act. They are both still bills, but Congress is in recess, and we fully expect that they will take it up again when they return in September.
And I believe that people are suggesting that the system may get the designation that it needs.
There seems to be a lot of movement toward it. We've been very excited. We have a bipartisan caucus in the House for the National Landscape Conservation System. We have a group of conservation organizations that support us. There are probably 50 of them. They're known as the Conservation Alliance. So there's a lot of momentum building for a relatively new system, mm-hmm. but one that I think offers several opportunities to Americans. For those of us like me who grew up in the East, like you, my first trip west, and I was much older, absolutely blew me away. The West opened up, and I embraced it. It was just amazing. So we offer the opportunity for folks like me to go out and see the West the way it was, and frankly, the way we'd like to see it continue in these areas. It also offers the opportunity for local communities to keep what is near and dear to them, their own cultures, their own histories, their own stories, whatever they may be. And it offers an opportunity for people to go out as the West develops, to go out and find themselves. I'm a great believer in the connection between individual spirit and the land. We need that We need to touch it. We need to experience it. You can do that. You can go into one of these areas and not see another human being for a weekend, maybe. It's a phenomenal system.
We're talking with Ellen Adeli, who's the director of the National Landscape Conservation System, about the importance of these areas, literally, to our well-being. Why is it so important, beyond just the fact that it's a land that could be lost? I'll let you go ahead and wax poetic.
Well, I'm not going to guarantee poetry, but I can give you heartfelt. The tagline that we use for the system is Landscapes of the American Spirit.
I like that, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. I wish I could take credit for it. I can't. But it always takes me back to my visits to any one of these areas. Continental Divide Trail is one of our units. And I stood on the Continental Divide a couple of years ago and could almost see wagons coming across the vista.
The mind sort of creates that.
It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, and that's the kind of experience you get out there. I was at Pompey's Pillar and saw Clark's signature on the pillar. There are only two tangible evidences of the Lewis and Clark Trail. That's one of them. And you stand there and you think, my word, I really believe that as a people, to know where you're going, you have to know where you've been. And that's what these places tell us, all the way back to, as you mentioned, the prehistoric evidence, but more importantly, the human evidence, the tribal histories, the first settlers along the Spanish Trail, or those who took the Mormon Trail or the Oregon-California Trail and headed west. My family never did. They're all still in New Jersey, so I'm particularly intrigued by people who would cross country on foot. I mean, that's an amazing story. And then when you see what they saw, whoever that first visitor was, you literally gasp in a lot of these places. So to me, it really is rooted in who we are as a nation. And if we lose it, we will be unsure of where we are going. And I mean that ecologically, socially, and culturally.
You're absolutely right. It's possible to re-experience history almost as they did. If you just imagine that the car isn't there, that perhaps you're on foot or on horseback, and this could be from Native American cultures, or it could be from as the American West was being developed, but people had to cross those landscapes. For me, I don't have words at this moment to describe exactly what it is, but it fills me with a sense of purpose, in the sense that sometimes I can feel my relationship to the grand land.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's true. I think the other thing it does is it gives you your place in the universe. It kind of grounds you. And whether it's the great view, if you're in one of those amazing vistas like Grand Staircase, or it's the Clark signature, or a petroglyph you happen to come across, it just sort of fills your heart. It's an amazing experience.
Another aspect of this is just the natural beauty. As a landscape painter, I've traveled extensively throughout the West in particular, and I wish that everybody could have that experience. Your mission is to preserve this so that people can. And I actually think that America is kind of going through a change right now, and we've been thinking globally for a long time, and I think there's a resurgence of nationalism, and I'm all for it. I really believe that the diversity of peoples on this planet, the preservation of that diversity is critical to our survival, spiritual, cultural, economic, physical, that we really must find our balance with our place, and certainly that's the case with the diversity in America in its many perspectives. So I'm encouraging everybody to do precisely what we're talking about here, and that is to head out into these lands, because it will reestablish that connection with who we are.
Absolutely. Google us. We're there. Call, write.
For people who wish to know more about the system, where should they go on the internet?
You can either Google National Landscape Conservation System, and it will pull up articles. It will pull up our website. You can go to the BLM.gov homepage. There's a link there as well. Or if you happen to know of a unit, for instance, you might be interested in the old Spanish Trail, you can Google that, and that will give you information, too. So you can pull it up by state. You can pull it up nationally. You can pull it up by unit. And if all else fails, you can always email me, and I'll send you information. And that's at ELENA_DALY@BLM.gov.
Wow, now that's a dedicated public servant. I'll tell you, I've never heard such dedication. Congratulations to you. That's great.
Thank you.
That is really, really terrific. Let's talk a little bit about some of the challenges that you face to preserving these systems. What do you consider to be, we'll say, like the top three challenges to these conservation units?
I think one of the first challenges we have is, frankly, we're not very well known. That's why I really appreciate this opportunity, Sydney. Making people aware of this wonderful system and having Americans understand what it means to them is one of the biggest challenges we have. We're a small agency, and we're the government. I mean, most people, you know, look a little askance at that. But I do want to get the word out. So that's the first challenge we have. Some of the others, quite frankly, are ecological issues in the West, and one is the growth of invasive weeds, which is a huge problem. It's not as big for us as it is in several other lands, but it's one that, if you allow to take over, will literally take over. And so we're working very closely with a number of people to manage that. The other is visitation. We're not real sure how many people come because we're open. It's not like the parks. You don't have one place where you can go in. We have a lot of different areas. And we like having people come in, but as I said, it's a very remote area. It's very rugged country, a lot of it, and I worry from the sense of visitor safety that people understand that they're not going to Disneyland, frankly, that we have to do a really good job of educating the public about what they might be getting into. And so if, for instance, someone showed up from, let's say, my hometown in New Jersey and didn't understand you needed to take water into some of these places, that's not something is acceptable to me. So we're working very hard on educating people as they come in.
Since you're directing this program, you really get it probably more than anybody else does right now. And what I think would be fun is for you to choose three of your favorite areas. One kind of the northern tier, the Montanas and Idaho and Washington. One in kind of the mid-zone and perhaps one in the southwest. Could you pick out three that people, if they were to go to one, they might really get something spectacular from their visit there?
The Upper Missouri Breaks in Montana. If anyone was involved at all or aware of the Lewis and Clark commemoration a few years ago, I read Stephen Ambrose's book, Undaunted Courage, right before I went up to Montana. You can literally take that book or take the diaries of Lewis and Clark, and you will be looking at exactly what they were looking at all through that monument. It is phenomenal. So Upper Missouri Breaks is a wonderful little visitor center in a town called Fort Benton, which is probably 1,500 people. It's a delightful little town, and it's a wonderful little visitor center. It's not real big, but it gets a lot of information out in a hurry. Well, let me do the southern tier
first.
Sure,
fine.
The one that resonated with me from the first moment I saw it was Kashikatui Tent Rocks. And that's that geologic formation I mentioned between Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And for several reasons, it's a very unique, it's a conical shape, with these little capstones on the top, and you can actually see where they're eroding away. It's not a large monument. It's on the Cochiti Pueblo, and the Cochiti are lovely people. They co-manage the monument with us. It's a really great opportunity to learn about the tribal culture there. But you take this little mile hike or so up among these cones, and you look out when you reach the top across this valley of amazing geology. So that one's, for some reason, that has resonated with me, and I can't tell you why.
I've been there. It's a sacred little spot.
It is. Sacred's a good word for it. Yes, yeah, that's a good word. And I think in the midsection, the historic trails also resonate with me. My background is in American history. As I said, that concept of what it took for people to pack up, to sell what they owned, and to take a four-month journey on foot across the country is just phenomenal. And whether you select the Oregon Trail, the California Trail, the Mormon Trail, the old Spanish trails are just as amazing to me. Any one of those trails, when I talk about them, I talk about them as the threads that bind us, that bind the fabric of the nation together. And they really, they're very special to me too.
You know, the one thing I would encourage everybody to do, there's a movement that is thrilling to me, and it's the No Child Left Indoors movement.
Yes.
And it basically says that kids these days aren't getting outdoors and that it's affecting their literal development, and I totally agree with that. I was very fortunate to grow up at a time when I could just head out and go almost anywhere. But I think it's really critical for parents right now to help their kids experience these things. So I think there's no better way to do that than to head out into units of the National Landscape Conservation System and allow their minds to imagine whatever they will, because that's what they're lacking. They're sitting in front of computers. They're spending all their time watching TV. You hardly see kids outside anymore. And that developmentally, they're being impaired because they don't have the opportunity to just think and imagine in wild and wonderful places. So if I were to say one purpose of the National Landscape Conservation System, and that is to help children and parents and their children share what we've been talking about here.
Oh, absolutely. We'd love to see them out there.
Elena Daly, Director of the National Landscape Conservation System, it's been great talking with you, and this is one of my little personal missions. I'm going to do everything I can to help people become familiar with this. We're going to talk on a regular basis and hopefully get some stories from the communities and the people who are living there such that we can share that real sense of, as you say, the landscape of the American spirit. What a wonderful, wonderful vision that is. Elena, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sydney. I appreciate it.
I'll be going to space. Once more, my parents and children will be coming with me. Best of all, we, and I hope you, will be traveling on a spaceship owned and operated by Virgin Galactic.
We are moving into a whole new age. Up until now, even those wealthiest few were earthbound creatures. But now, people are pushing out and away from our Earth in amazing and astonishing ways. And those left behind are increasingly left to scramble and fight for what's left. It's not good or bad. It's called progress. And humans are addicted to it. To paraphrase one of the most successful programs to fight addiction, the 12-step program of AA, we have to admit that we are powerless over our addiction, that our lives have become unmanageable.
That you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Tuesday or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth rings out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.